This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Iraqi media say at least 9 people have been killed in an apparent U.S. air raid on the positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units in Babil province. The U.N. Secretary General urges Israel to halt and reverse its recent decision to build 800 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Also coming up, Iran says it will return to the full implementation of its JCPOA obligations if the EUS and E3 fully meet their commitments under the nuclear deal. Our top story this hour. The U.S. military has reportedly carried out airstrikes in the Iraqi province of Babil. Local media say the airstrikes hit the town of Jufash al-Sakhr, causing at least 3 explosions. They say the U.S. attack targeted positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units. According to the Iraqi reports, at least 9 people were killed as a result. The Iraqi government has not made any comments so far. But U.S. Central Command has posted a tweet. It said the explosions were not the result of U.S. military action. The U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged Israel to halt and reverse its recent plan to build new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Guterres said Israel's settlement construction in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967 has no legal validity. He said such activities are a flagrant violation under international law. According to the UN chief, Israel's expansionism further erodes the possibility of ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state. Israel approved the construction of 780 new settler units on Sunday, following an order by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. An Israeli settlement watchdog has said most of the units will be built deep in the West Bank. All Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law.
Tunisian police have clashed with demonstrators as nationwide protests against the police and an economic crisis enter their third night. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons to quell the protests in the capital, Tunis. The protesters were throwing stones, gasoline bombs, and burning tires at security forces. The demonstrations began on Friday after a video went viral showing an officer pushing a shepherd whose animals entered a government building. Police say they have arrested over 1,000 people involved in the rioting. The protests also followed the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising that pushed former President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali from power. 10 years on, anger is growing at chronic unemployment levels and poor state services in the country. Meanwhile, President Kais Saied has asked people to stop violent protests, warning that some political forces are trying to sow chaos. The ground force of the Iranian army has launched large maneuvers in the south of the country. The maneuvers involve airborne divisions as well as special forces and rapid reaction forces. The exercises feature operations across a large stretch of sea, land, and mountainous areas. Domestically developed tactics are also used to boost rapid reaction troops' preparedness to break into enemy lines. Most of the military hardware and equipment used in the ongoing Iranian maneuvers have been produced domestically. The main objective of the drills is to assess the combat capability of rapid reaction brigades and divisions of the Iranian army. Let's cross there to the site of the maneuvers, joined there by our correspondent, Houman Abedi. Houman, you're there on the ground. What have you seen? What have you observed? What have you heard?
Bissam, today the maneuver called Iqtedar 99 or Power 99 started here in Jask, port city. The first stage of that started in the morning. They kicked off early in the morning, and the airborne forces as well as the special forces and quick response units with together are going to stage this exercise. As you know, this is the first time that the ground forces of the army are staging war games based on the changes applied to the structure of the ground forces according to the order of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It means that this is the first time that they are conducting the maneuver in an offensive way. In the morning, some C-130 airplanes flew from Shiraz, and then they carried some parachuters and some forces, and the parachuters, when reached to the area, they descended from the helicopter along with their equipment. And then they got on their armored vehicles, which were descended for them as well. And then they moved toward some kind of mock enemy targets in the field. And while some artillery equipment, including 107 artillery and also 23 millimeters artilleries, started to support them. And then they attacked the mock enemy targets and destroyed their positions. And then they moved toward the beach. This was the first stage, and the second stage is going to be conducted within some hours, and you know, in the evening, some forces would be carried to the region by Chinook choppers, and then they will, you know, stage the other, you know, the other stages of the exercise. In the evening, most of the activities would be focused on at sea maneuvers, and some divers will descend on the sea, and then they will swim to the shore to destroy some other positions at the beach, and they will also attack and target the enemy, hypothetical enemies at sea. Wissam?
Okay, Humar, thank you very much indeed for that. Humar Abedi there at the scene of the Iranian military drills ongoing, so we'll keep you up to date with the events there in the coming hours. Now, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on all the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to uphold their end of the bargain. In an interview, Majid Takht Ravanchi pointed to U.S. obligations under the international accord and UN Resolution 2231, which endorsed the agreement. He said not only the U.S., but the European parties must also respect their commitments under the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The Iranian diplomats said the administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, that is, must lift all the sanctions mentioned in Resolution 2231, adding that Tehran won't accept Washington meeting its obligations halfway.
Over the past few years, the U.S. has changed the name of some of the sanctions that were lifted under the JCPOA. For example, it has renamed the sanctions imposed on Iran's central bank. This is not our problem. It's up to the Americans to solve their problems. It's unacceptable for us to hear them say, we will comply with the JCPOA, but we won't lift these sanctions because they have been recategorized.
Takht Ravanchi further said that Iran will go back to full compliance with its obligations under the deal once all parties do the same. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, announced a gradual scale back of its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to meet their obligations. Political analyst Tim Anderson says the U.S. pressure campaign against Iran is a pretext to contain and the influence and leverage Tehran enjoys in the region.
Yes, I think there's going to be a big struggle within the Biden administration or behind the Biden administration, because the point of this, of course, is not really about the nuclear industry. It's a pretext to try and contain the influence, the leverage that Iran has in the region. And in the last decade, with the wars that the U.S. has conducted, necessarily the coalition of groups has come together, and Iran's role has become more important. So I think the political argument really within the U.S. after the 20th of January will be, you know, how are we going to get some more leverage in this situation? That will make it very difficult for Biden, even though he was in the administration that agreed to the JCPOA in the first place, to go back without trying to impose some sort of extra demands. And of course, Iran has no incentive really to comply with any additional demands. So Iran is in a strong diplomatic position, but I think there's a great risk that the Biden administration won't be able to find a way to go back to original agreement.
More bad news for the outgoing U.S. president. A new poll shows Donald Trump's approval rating has plunged to the lowest as he prepares to leave office. According to a Gallup poll, a whopping 66% of Americans disapprove of the way Trump is handling the presidency. Just 34% of those surveyed approved of his job. Trump had an average of 41% approval rating throughout his presidency, which is 4 points lower than for any of his predecessors. His role in inciting a violent mob that stormed the Capitol and a second House impeachment are reasons behind his dwindling popularity. The new poll comes just 2 days before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. Meanwhile, Trump is expected to issue around 100 pardons and commutations for his controversial allies and white-collar criminals during his remaining days. And it's inauguration week in the United States, but it looks more like a nation at war a deeply disputed presidential election is finally reaching a definite conclusion. But only amid widespread fears of unprecedented violence, Ramin Mazahari has more from Chicago.
Inauguration week is normally a time of optimism, conciliation, and unity in the United States, but it's the most tense handover of power in recent memory. 25,000 troops have locked down Washington, D.C. It's a force greater than the alleged number of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Widely expected armed protests at state capitals nationwide ahead of the inauguration have not materialized. The greater number of public protests seem to be to demand that Donald Trump leaves office.
It's our job to make sure that the far right is afraid. I mean, they shouldn't be able to occupy public spaces. They shouldn't be able to present an organized force. You know, and really, I think that's the big thing that we should be pushing for, that people on the left need to be organizing, because the right certainly is.
The show of military strength is a deterrent for political protests, but it's clear that American division is vast and maybe permanent. A new CNN poll shows that at least 35% of the country, a significant and seemingly entrenched minority, still doesn't believe Joe Biden won the election legitimately. Dragnets for people suspected of joining the recent Capitol Hill protest. No fly lists. Families informing on each other to security forces. Rampant fears of domestic terror attacks. A year of incredible political division is culminating in an inauguration week which few could imagine.
You know, really what we're seeing is a response to the rise of the far right, that people are taking that really seriously. And I mean, we're certainly out here talking with folks about the way that you respond to this is not just by waiting for, you know, Biden and the Democrats to respond, you know, to the far right, which they haven't done in the past 4 years.
Political tensions have been further inflamed by this month's rapid second impeachment of Trump, as well as the prospect of a deeply divisive Senate trial of the soon-to-be ex-president during Biden's very first weeks in office. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. The economic catastrophe continues to deepen, and more political battles loom. It's an inauguration week consumed with tragedies and fears. The nation will remain on almost civil war footing until Inauguration Day, January 20th, and probably afterwards. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Venezuela is to indict former opposition congressmen who plotted with the U.S. in robbing Venezuela's oil assets abroad. The socialist-led Congress has stressed a criminal process is underway against opposition figure Juan Guaido and many of his Congress fellows who helped the U.S. decree the confiscation of Citgo, among other Venezuelan companies. From Caracas, Jesus Silva tells us more.
The Venezuelan parliament has announced that it will indict U.S.-backed opposition ex-congressman involved in the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan oil industry assets perpetrated by the U.S. government. The socialist-led Congress, also known as National Assembly, has stated that it will develop the legal process with the country's judiciary system in order to hold accountable those Venezuelans who, in association with the ongoing administration of Donald Trump, inflicted economic damage to the South American country through illegal U.S. sanctions. Among those politicians to be indicted, there is Juan Guaido and many of his associates. The legislative branch says Guaido contributed with Washington in the illegal confiscation of Citgo, the Venezuelan oil company based in the U.S., which is worth billions of dollars. Experts say U.S. and Citgo has caused Venezuela's ongoing scarcity of gasoline nationwide.
Billions of dollars have been robbed from Venezuela through illegal confiscation of Citgo, so Guaido must be held accountable for helping the U.S. in this robbery.
But some opposition members decry the indictment.
Legal process against opposition ex-congressmen are politically motivated, and the excuse is the U.S. sanctions that are not ruled by Venezuelans.
But legal experts say Guaido and his camp are the main collaborators of the U.S. sanctions.
It is documented that Guaido and his cronies requested the U.S. government to issue savage economic sanctions against Venezuela as a strategy to force President Maduro's resignation. Guaido and his team are guilty.
The indictment of the opposition ex-congressman who plotted with the U.S. in the robbery of Venezuela's oil assets abroad is well seen by millions of Venezuelans who nowadays suffer the country's economic crisis caused by U.S. sanctions. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Meanwhile, Guatemalan security forces have cleared a road blocked by hundreds of migrants, mostly Hondurans, on their way to the United States. Police forces, armed with batons and shields, dispersed the migrants who had camped out overnight on a road in eastern Guatemala. Minor clashes have also been reported there. A caravan with 8,000 migrants departed Honduras on Friday, but has been held up near the Guatemalan borders. The Guatemalan government says it cannot allow them to pass without travel documents or a negative coronavirus test. The Honduran migrants flee poverty and violence in their homeland, where things have recently got worse because of the pandemic. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished, give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Limelight.
A new report found that senior U.S. administration officials were fully aware that the zero-tolerance migrant family separation policy would result in children being separated from their families, but pressed ahead with it anyway. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New IG Report Finds Proof of Trump Team Cruelty to Asylum Seekers. Here's the details of this article. As a former leading U.S. Justice Department official recently said, he regretted the role he played in the Trump administration's zero-tolerance migrant family separation policy in the wake of a scathing Inspector General report. Human and civil rights groups pointed to the probe's findings as damning proof of the administration's cruelty toward people seeking refuge in the United States. The Inspector General's report concluded that President Donald Trump, ex-Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and other senior officials were woefully unprepared when U.S. agents started seizing thousands of migrant children from their asylum-seeking parents and relatives who were often imprisoned in concentration camps after entering the United States. First, in a 2017 DOJ pilot program and then nationwide the following year. The report, based on interviews with dozens of DOJ officials and a review of over 200,000 emails and other electronic files, directly implicates Trump in the disastrous policy. It also found that senior administration officials were fully aware that the policy would result in children being separated from their families, but pressed ahead with it anyway. In response to the report, former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein released recently a statement of regret. Since leaving the department, I have often asked myself what we should have done differently, and no issue has dominated my thinking more than the zero-tolerance immigration policy. Rosenstein told NBC News, "It was a failed policy that never should have been proposed or implemented. I wish we all had done better." The ACLU, which successfully sued to block family separation and immediately reunite families, led human and civil rights groups in reacting to what it called the damning report. The barbaric family separation practice was immoral and illegal, said Lee Glurant, the ACLU lawyer who led the family separation suit, in a statement recently. This new report shows just how far the Trump administration was willing to go to destroy these families. Just when you think the Trump administration can't sink any lower, it does. The new DOJ report's findings correspond with those of a 21-month House Judiciary Committee investigation published last October that accused the Trump administration of reckless incompetence and intentional cruelty in its implementation of the zero-tolerance policy. In November, Common Dreams reported that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of five, when they were ripped away from their parents, remained separated from their families. As a result of the separation policy, both parents and children, who were often told by U.S. officials that they would never see each other again, have suffered tremendous emotional and psychological trauma that Physicians for Human Rights has called torture and state-sanctioned child abuse. Some of the CIS children have been placed in U.S. families, who are sometimes able to petition for permanent custody, and it is feared that some of the children may indeed never see their parents again. In late June 2018, as public outrage mounted in the face of stories like a breastfeeding baby being torn away from her mother and a father driven to suicide after being separated from his wife and child, the administration reluctantly rolled back the policy, which, along with forced surgical removal of reproductive organs of migrant women, has been called the Trump administration's worst domestic human rights violation. During the 2020 election, Joe Biden vowed to form a task force to reunite all of the separated children with their relatives. Glurant stressed that he must now follow through on his promise. The Biden-Harris administration will inherit the legacy of family separation, and we don't doubt that more horrific details will continue to emerge, the ACLU attorney said. We need them to act with urgency. Every day without action makes it harder to find and reunite families. The incoming administration must reunite the separate families in the United States, but we cannot stop there, Glurant added. These families deserve citizenship, resources, care, and a commitment that family separation will never happen again.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. We're coming to you from the British capital here in London. My name's Amina Taylor, and we start with our top story. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has downplayed the international reaction following the arrest of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Navalny was detained after arriving from Berlin on Sunday, where he was treated following an alleged nerve agent poisoning back in August.
We can see how they jumped at yesterday's news about Navalny's return to Russia, and we can see how gladly the comments, which replicate one another, are being done. They are doing so happily, as it looks like Western politicians view this as an opportunity to draw attention away from the deepest crisis the liberal development model has found itself in.
Navalny's detention was widely expected, as the critic of the Kremlin had violated parole terms from a suspended sentence dating back to a 2014 embezzlement conviction. Under the terms of his parole, he was required to return to Russia after his treatment in Germany, but this was delayed for over 2 months. Navalny will now serve 30 days in prison and will be required to continue abiding by the rules of his parole. Well, Mohsen Abbas, political commentator, has been watching this one keenly. And Mohsen, I mean, Navalny must have known that he would have been arrested on his return. Was this a nice bit of show for the Western audience here?
I think so. Alexei Navalny is simply a puppet within a sort of Western game of actually trying to disrupt and put Russia in an internal, if you like, issue. He does have a considerable following. Again, one has to beg the question how on earth he got such a massive following on social media. I mean, just an anti-corruption campaigner, really. That's all he was. But he's turned into this figurehead, which again is it smacks of color revolution style operations in the background to boost this individual, and of course this provides them yet another opportunity to really highlight him and to put the Russians under pressure. But of course, really the real backdrop to this is the downward spiral in Russian and European or Western relations ever since the Ukrainian Crimean interference by the Western regimes, and of course Russia's response to that has been also to put down the similar color revolutions they've been trying to orchestrate in Belarus, and at the same time this Alexei Navalny issue is thrown up as yet another quite comical, if you like, saga, which serves that kind of cyber warfare suppression of Russian, if you like, reemergence, what with their support with China building up the Eurasian alliances, their reemergence in Middle Eastern politics successfully, and across Africa as well. This is troubling for the Western democracies, which actually Mr. Lavrov has pointed out is the fundamental problem. They're so insecure with their own performances in their own sort of neoliberal so-called democracies that they have to constantly be trying to find ways.
Indeed, and Mohsen, very quickly here, you touched on a couple of the things that you so wisely mentioned there, including the fact that this can be quite a distraction technique. But can you imagine Moscow trying to dictate the UK's terms here, which is essentially what the West wants to do with Russia?
It's unthinkable, because of course they do from time to time blame the Russians for interfering in the election processes of America. Even in Britain, they sort of intimated it with Jeremy Corbyn. So they do try to put these allegations on the Russians. They also, I mean, the Financial Times put out a whole article, I think a little while back, accusing the Russians of having relations with the right wing in Europe. So essentially saying that Russia is fomenting the right-wing movements across Europe, which is it's laughable, really, to the extent that the Russians won't have that degree of influence within sort of fascist-style politics, which opposes their kind of philosophy in the first place. But really, all of this is ultimately their fear that Russians' growing influence in Eurasia, with all of the recent Azerbaijan and Armenia, if you like, peace that they evolved, their relations with Turkey building. opening up Salo S-400, their relations with Iran and Syria. All of this is concerning the Westerners. Biden is coming in, and they've obviously fired a few salvos already now. NSA incoming, Jake Sullivan.
Those are, in fact, pertinent points to watch, and we'll continue to do so. Mohsen, thank you, as always. Mohsen Abbas there for us. And we move to some other news now, because with infection soaring, governments in the United Kingdom and across Europe are desperately trying to get a handle on the pandemic through measures like national lockdowns and mass immunization programs. In Britain, more than 3.8 million people have already received the COVID jab, and in other EU countries, mass vaccination programs are underway. Saeed Poreza fills us in this update.
With only one way out of the pandemic, no building in Britain is being overlooked in a bid to vaccinate the nation. This church in northwest England, the latest experiencing its own conversion from church to vaccination center. One of 10 opening this week, as the government announced a rollout was headed in the right direction.
We've got the light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccine rollout. We just got to stay at home as much as possible, unless there are really strong, limited exceptional reasons.
The government's aim is to immunize 15 million people in the high-risk group by the middle of next month and another 17 million by spring, when they're hoping to ease lockdown restrictions.
We are aiming to complete all of our residents in care homes by the end of next week. We're aiming to complete everybody over 70, all the clinically extremely vulnerable, and all health and social care staff by the middle of February.
But as mass immunization in the UK goes into overdrive, how are some other COVID hotspots in the continent faring? In neighboring France, a nationwide campaign to inoculate people over 75 has gotten underway, as officials seek to ease concern about deliveries of vaccines. Spain, too, has launched its inoculation program, while it tries to avoid a full-scale lockdown.
We do not contemplate at this time any home confinement. We overcame the second wave without home confinement.
Mass vaccination is also ongoing in other rich European countries, such as Italy, the epicenter of the pandemic in Europe, as well as in Austria, Norway, and Switzerland, where the fight to push down high infection figures is ongoing. Back in the UK, the latest measure, a closure of travel corridors. As of Monday, all arrivals in the UK will have to quarantine for 10 days and show proof of a negative test. The government is fearful new variants of coronavirus could derail the vaccine rollout.
We've seen the rising numbers of infections of coronavirus, both domestically and internationally. We've taken the view that it's now the right time, as we're looking at the data, to take some extra steps.
Accused of moving too slowly in keeping COVID out, the British government is now desperate to stay ahead in getting jabs into people's arms and fast. And as for the rest of the continent, the race against the clock is on. Saeed Poreza, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Ahmed Caballo will commemorate a very special anniversary, and one, dare I say, that would have passed many of us by.
Yes, so January the 17th was the 60th anniversary of what people are calling one of the most significant assassinations of the 21st century, and that is of Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected Prime Minister of the Congo. Now, the Congo, many people estimate to be the wealthiest country in the world based on the natural resources that lie within its borders. But according to the GDP, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. And that's because before Patrice Lumumba and shortly after Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, the wealth of the Congo has been used to enrich European powers and American elites. And that is why he was assassinated. So as the years have gone on, we've found out that it wasn't only the Belgian authorities that were responsible for his assassination, but they were in cahoots with President Eisenhower, the CIA, and MI6, who all wanted to get rid of the man who wanted to nationalize natural resources and make sure that the workers in the Congo that produce the wealth that the Europeans and the Americans rely on were paid a fair wage for their work. And what's worrying about this is, on the day of its independence on June 30th, 1960, Patrice Lumumba made this very passionate speech, and some people say that it was this speech that made him a marked man, that made him be seen as a potential threat to Western interests.
Quick reaction and into the comments there, Ahmed.
Yeah, so you notice the Belgian king did not clap at the idea that the Congolese were no longer to be treated as second-class citizens or they would be paid a fair wage, and that was the reason. Now we'll get on to some of the tweets. Rubber Q says, on this day, 1961, Patrice Lumumba, freedom fighter and anti-imperialist, was kidnapped and assassinated by firing squad. After urgent Belgian and CIA directives were issued, his body was desecrated and his legacy of national uplift in the Congo was shattered. He died at the age of 35. And one final point, his body was dismembered and put in sulfuric acid because they did not want the symbol of what he represents to live on long after he was killed.
All right, your next story.
This is an interesting one. So it was the number one trending topic in the United States, and it was after Donald Trump, or after Trump. And it was quite interesting to me because so many Americans are saying, after Trump, everything will be great again. It was great before. Donald Trump was a small interruption of how of American politics, which was a great force for good in the world. But now he's gone, everything will get back to normal. Now, we'll read a couple of these tweets and we'll get into some of my thoughts and analysis. So, Untrumped says, after Trump, I will have hope again. Jay Braps says, after Trump, I will channel my energy into healing from the abuse and trauma of his administration and get back to being a happy and healthy human being. Now, one of the problems with this thing that was trending, it doesn't spare a thought to the people of the Global South whose lives were decimated by Barack Obama's administration, by George W. Bush's administration, and Bill Clinton's administration before that. Although Donald Trump has done many terrible things, 330,000 Americans have died because of COVID, they do not seem to care or have any understanding of the true horrors of U.S. empire, the children in Fallujah that are born with birth deficiencies, the over a million dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, the predator drone strikes enacted by Barack Obama's administration. All those people are insignificant because the only problem in the U.S. system, in the eyes of those tweeting, was Donald Trump, and that is very problematic. Indeed. And we've got one final tweet by Nada. She says, after Trump, he'll be the first president in 152 years to skip his successor's inauguration. He'll be forever known as a one-term, twice-impeached loser. He'll be the first president to have so many terrible first president awards. Tired of so much winning.
Well, we'll see pretty soon whether or not this rather rosy, tainted image is correct. Ahmed Kabbalah, thank you very, very much. And we move on to some other stories now because the Israeli regime have advanced plans to build nearly 800 homes in settlements across the occupied West Bank. According to anti-settlement monitoring group Peace Now, Tel Aviv authorized the plans on Sunday evening in a last-minute bid of approval. This just a week before close ally to the Israeli regime, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump, leaves office. According to Peace Now, 90% of the settlement units lie deep within the occupied West Bank. Both the European Union and the United Kingdom have condemned the move, both stating that it undermines the prospect of a viable two-state solution. Now, Yusuf Al-Khalou, independent journalist, is with us from London. Yusuf, the application, the decision, these were all rushed through. Wasn't this about making the most of Trump's final days in office here for Netanyahu?
Yes, indeed, Amina. If it is a house cleaning for Trump to finalize his promises to his friend in need, Netanyahu. I guess the green light which Israel enjoys is because of the impunity and the support, the green light given to Israel by Trump. So it's a matter of speeding, accelerating these settlements before Biden takes office. And we know that Netanyahu has been favored a lot by Trump's reckless decisions. And we know that the story of Jerusalem leaving the embassy and not considering Israel's illegal occupation illegal anymore. So it's a house cleaning in my mind. And I think Palestinians, they do not really pin high hopes on the next president, Biden, when it comes to Israel's violation of international law.
Why do you think that is, Yusuf?
It's because the American administration has never been an honest peace broker. And Palestinians, they, somehow they have doubts about Biden's really, if he's going to be like pro-democracy or let's say respects international law. But on the main hand, on the main side, Palestinians, they demand Biden to restore the international system, to allow Palestinians to have their dignity, to pressure Israel to end its prolonged occupation. But as I said, doubts are high. And when it comes to the U.S. administration, the policy stays the same, but you know, people come and go, different faces for the same currency.
Indeed, and you mentioned dignity there, but also health we should like to mention, because we've seen much being made of Israel rolling out its vaccine, yet Palestinians are on the sidelines still waiting. Briefly, Yusuf, your thoughts on that?
Well, Israel prides itself as a country that managed to vaccinate about 20% of its population. But unfortunately, the international regime, or let's say the international community, forgets that Israel occupies a large number of Palestinians under the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And Israel hesitates, or let's say refuses, to allow these vaccinations to reach the Palestinian population, or at least to vaccinate Palestinian key workers or paramedics who transfer patients across checkpoints when it comes to the bantustans of the West Bank. And also, let's not forget the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners held in Israeli jails in crowded cells. And those vulnerable people, they risk the lives. Israel disregards the health of those people. Many of them, they've got chronic diseases. And we hear from officials in Israel that they do care about democracy, or let's say their fellow human beings. But we know from previous experiences, you know, Israel considered Palestinians subhumans. And unfortunately, the world is watching. The WHO also pressures Israel to abide by the international law by allowing these vaccinations to reach Palestinians. But all these calls fall in deaf ears.
Same story, unfortunately, Yusuf. Thank you so very much. Now we move across to Italy, where the country's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte has announced that Italy will enter into a new series of restrictions aimed at containing the resistance COVID-19 surge. Under the new plans, all non-essential businesses have been closed and non-essential travel between provinces barred. The opening of ski resorts has also been postponed for a second time. Italy has been operating on a three-tier set of restrictions, with red zones put on partial lockdown, allowing outings only for urgent reasons like work, grocery shopping, or the pharmacy. Now the new measures will stay in force until the 5th of March this year. Snowfall and cold weather conditions have disrupted land and sea traffic in Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, on Monday. Traffic was brought to a halt by a blanket of snow covering the city, with some cars stalled or skidding on the roads. The heavy snowfall, which is expected to continue into Wednesday, has prompted Istanbul's Disaster Coordination Center to issue warnings for citizens. The city will also be housing some 1,200 homeless people in hotels during the freezing conditions. Robert Inlakesh, they're counting down the days until Joe Biden takes office. But what does this mean in terms of real-world politics right now?
Well, the story that we're looking at today is an intriguing one because, of course, Joe Biden has sworn to be a lot better, been the previous president, still president right now, Donald Trump, when it comes to border control and immigration into the United States. But this story here is perhaps shining a light on what is to perhaps come. A Biden aide has told 8,000 Honduran migrants that heading to the United States, that they should turn back and that the border would not be open immediately to them. And on top of that as well, other people close to Joe Biden, the incoming Biden administration, have said that there will be changes taking place. However, they will not take place immediately. And so this will take quite a bit of time to come into effect. And what we're seeing is a reluctance to take in many people that Joe Biden has sworn that he would perhaps take in, or that at least he'd deal with it better. We do know, however, that Joe Biden was vice president under Barack Obama. You know, Barack Obama deported a lot more people than Donald Trump deported, and those infamous cages where children were being kept in the Trump years were actually built under the Obama administration, where, of course, Joe Biden was vice president. So a lot of people are calling into question as to whether Joe Biden is going to be that much better. There is a claim that this will change, but we're going to have to see how this all turns out.
And the reaction to this has been what, Rob?
There's been a mixture of reactions, of course, as you can imagine. This story is whipping up a lot of tension, especially between Trump supporters and Biden supporters. The first commenting on this, we have here a Twitter user saying, hilarious to watch racist idiots go crazy over 8,000 people and claim Joe Biden is going to allow an invasion. In reality, Biden is doing the opposite of what he promised. It looks like he won't even consider letting them in. Then we got another one here from I suspect, Trump supporter, Last Beacon of Hope, God Bless America, that's their account, and they say, and so it begins because phony Biden told them they were welcome to break into America, say goodbye to safety, jobs, and resources. The Biden looting begins, migrant caravan in Guatemala pushes through border from Honduras, heading to the United States of America. A lot of fear-mongering there, as you could imagine.
And attached to this story, though a separate one, very briefly, just bring us up to speed with, well, the fate of some of those who protested in the summer demonstrations against the government in Beijing.
Well, this is a very interesting story to put alongside our previous one. That's the story of, specifically in this case, five protesters who are apparently prominent. We don't know their names. They haven't revealed their identities, who have are essentially seeking asylum inside of the United States. And they're being helped along by this organization based in Washington called the Hong Kong Democracy Council. Again, a lot of people are called into question, why would the Hong Kong Democracy Council based in Washington be helping these sort of people? We also know that the National Endowment for Democracy has been feeding these protests, which have been ongoing, as an attempt to get at the Chinese authorities inside of Hong Kong over a security bill that was drafted and, of course, was changed. So what we have here is an example of the United States looking to take in people with ease from Hong Kong. We know that the United Kingdom has offered for people in Hong Kong who were born prior to the 1997 hand back to Beijing of Hong Kong, that they would offer them citizenship now as well.
It so is, these and sort of very briefly, support. Give me your last tweet on this one.
So the final tweet that we have here is from some guy with opinions who says, let this sink in, not a single protester has been killed by Hong Kong police in years of on and off protests. This despite them being so violent and having killed police. Democrats go crazy at what happened at the Capitol, but when it happens in Hong Kong, it's revolution and social media promotes it.
All right, we leave it there, Robert Inlakesh, and we leave you there. Stay tuned.
Limelight. Donald Trump is planning an early morning send-off event for himself at a military airfield in Maryland on Wednesday, 20th of January, several hours before his successor, Joe Biden, is inaugurated as the 46th U.S. president at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Joanna Walters and Martin Bellum. The piece is titled Trump to hold early morning send-off ceremony on Biden inauguration day. Stay with us for more of Joanna Walters and Martin Bellum's article.